Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. In late August of 2011, Vermont felt the devastating effects of Tropical Storm Irene. But we already had FEMA agents in the state at the time. That was because in the spring of that year, Vermont had seen some unprecedented flooding around the state, and water levels on Lake Champlain were extremely high. Later this year, we'll reflect on Irene, but it's just as important to recall what caused that year's spring flooding and the impact it had on the lake and those living on its shores. We're also going to discuss the lake's current health. Here to help us with all that is Eric Howe. He's the Lake Champlain Basin Program Director. Eric, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Eric a question, or if you want to share a memory of that flooding event from the spring of 2011, you can give us a call. The numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Eric, first, give us a little introduction to your organization, the Lake Champlain Basin Project.
Sure, the Lake Champlain Basin Program is not a problem. People get that mixed up all the time. So we are authorized by Congress within the Clean Water Act to coordinate the management of the Lake Champlain Basin or the watershed across Vermont and New York and also the province of Quebec. And through that authorization, we are able to receive funding from the EPA and a couple of other U.S. federal organizations to implement projects and programs and research across the basin to achieve our goals for Lake Champlain.
And generally, what comprises that Lake Champlain Basin?
Sure. So the Lake Champlain Basin stretches from at its southernmost end. It stretches from Lake George in New York and almost down to south of Rutland in Vermont. Then out eastward towards Hardwick, the eastern ends of the Lamoille River watershed and the Winooski River out in Cabot, up north to north of the border into the Missisquoi watershed. Missisquoi River stretches up into Quebec, and then westward out into the Saranac River area of the Adirondacks. And it's a pretty large chunk of land that drains into Lake Champlain.
Wow, that sure is, and that really gives us a great indication. How vividly, Eric, can you recall the flooding from 10 years ago?
Actually, very vividly. Our office is located up in Grand Isle, right near the ferry landing up here. And I was commuting up here from Chittenden County, and I remember when the causeway that crosses over on route two that crosses over from Milton and Colchester onto South Hero was flooded. Where the lake was actually over the road, and I was grateful at that point to have my truck and the clearance to get through the lake. I remember taking my 1-year-old son down to the lake and the waterfront in Burlington and check out how high the lake level was, it was less than a foot anyway from the edges of the Echo Leahy Center in the Burlington, it was a very memorable period of time for me and even more so for the folks who were living through it day and night, who had homes on the lakeshore itself.
Yeah. We always have snowpack, Eric, and rain falls in April and May. So what was different or extraordinary about that spring?
Yeah, so that year, it was kind of almost like a triple punch from Mother Nature. That previous fall, in the fall of 2010, we'd had a fair amount of rainfall that brought the lake level up higher, a little bit higher than usual going into the winter of 2011. And then in 2011, we had a great ski season. We had lots of snow, so it was a skier's dream winter that year. And then so we had a very, very large snowpack, particularly up in the mountains of the watershed. And then in late March to early April, the weather turned and we received a lot of rain, which then delivered all of that snowpack in the mountains directly into the river systems and then to the lake in a very short period of time. So, you know, folks, if we were able to show a kind of a graph or a curve of the lake elevation between early March and early May when the lake peaked, it's just like it almost goes, you know, it's pretty amazing how quickly the lake elevation, lake level rose in that two-month period of time.
How high was the lake level at that time?
So the lake peaked around May 3rd or 4th at 103 feet, 0.25 feet above sea level. The lake is considered to be at flood stage at 100 and even 100 feet above sea level. So there was a good, you know, 3 feet above what would be considered a normal flood stage. For context, right now, 10 years later, the lake is about 2.5 feet below what is the average lake level for this time of year. So, you know, if we were to, you know, so the lake is at about 96 and a half or so feet above sea level, or at least it was last night when I looked it up. You know, and then 10 years ago, it was 103 feet and change. So the lake's about 5.5 feet lower right now than it was 10 years ago.
Unbelievable. What other bodies of water in the area were affected from those flooding events?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not as familiar with other localized flooding events on what we could call inland lakes in the region. Mm-hmm. But the Richelieu River, which is something that a lot of us here south of the border don't often think about, is that Lake Champlain actually drains north through the Richelieu River, which is becomes the outlet of Lake Champlain, and then that sends the water up north up to the St. Lawrence River, a little bit northeast of Montreal. And there are a number of communities along the Richelieu River in Quebec that were flooded as well. There were actually many, many more people up there that were impacted by the floods than there were along the shoreline of Lake Champlain itself. There were thousands of people who were displaced from their homes up there for several months that you know were impacted by those floods.
I'm glad you mentioned the Richelieu because I always just kind of as a you know matter of geography always picture Lake Champlain draining southward, which is not the case. It does go, yeah, and so you have to kind of change your geography, your concept of geography to remember that it does, yeah, drain northward, Richelieu, and into the St. Lawrence Seaway. So it does affect what we do here, what happens here in Lake Champlain does affect our neighbors to the north in Quebec. Now, the tributaries, how were they affected by and you know, what would they have experienced back 10 years ago?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The tributaries, you know, so they delivered all of that water from the mountains and to the lake, and so they would have been running at what we would call bank full, perhaps some flooding, tributary flooding at that point. It was not like the flooding that we experienced later that year with Tropical Storm Irene. It was a more gradual. You know, with Irene, all that water came within, like a 24-hour period or something.
Right.
And so that was a very different situation than the spring. And, you know, that snowpack melted quickly, but we didn't have that massive erosive event that we had, that we saw with Irene in August of 2011. The rivers were very full. They were flowing, you know, a lot of water moving through them, but not quite the level of degree of flooding that we saw later that year.
I remember Isle Lamotte was in a serious state back then. And so,
yes.
Yeah. And other than the water rising up onto people's property, which is bad enough, what stress does an event like this place on the lake itself?
You know, you mean like the ecological
yes.
stress?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, the lake itself is designed for, for natural fluctuations in the lake level. Lake Champlain is not controlled in any way, which is why we see, you know, natural fluctuations in the lake. Like I was just saying a few minutes ago, you know, the lake is now currently 5.5 feet lower than it was 10 years ago. And Lake Champlain and most lake naturally or natural systems do fluctuate like that depending on, you know, the climate of the day, you know, whether, you know, we're in any kind of a drought or a wet season. And so the lake itself, is able to manage that. The ecosystem is able to manage that. We did see a lot of shoreline erosion, that year, along the lake that we hadn't experienced or the lake hadn't experienced, in quite some time because that was the highest that the lake had crested at, at least that we had measured anyway. So there was a lot of, soil that, eroded into the shore that hadn't really been accessed by the lake before, particularly on windy days, and as you mentioned, in Isle of Mott and other places along the shoreline. We have some nice aerial photos of sedimentation along Isle of Mott in particular, where there are no rivers. Usually when we see sedimentation or you know that muddy plume of sediment into the river, right, or into the lake, sorry, it's coming from a river. But, you know, Isle of Mott, there aren't any rivers up there, and there's just the same kind of sediment plume just from sediment eroding off the shoreline. Right. And that certainly had some impacts. You know, that delivers another supply of nutrients to the lake, and, you know, potentially any other contaminants that are in those soils. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk to someone who I think probably had another firsthand look at it. We're going to John in Mallett's Bay. Hi, John.
Hi. Good morning. How are you guys?
Great. Go right ahead.
Hey, a comment and also I think a question. I just want to mention you mentioned the snowpack, the great skiing prior to the flooding at Lake Champlain. We certainly did witness it down here in Mallett's Bay, although we weren't directly impacted ourselves. There was kind of some exacerbating circumstances there. You mentioned a lot of snow in Vermont that winter. What contributed mightily to this also was the fact that the entire Great Lakes water system was way, way up that year, which precipitated things like, you know, dam controls and water flows being controlled up into St. Lawrence, particularly around Montreal, et cetera, to prevent flooding in some of those areas. So it was kind of, you know, the lesser of two evils. And so to your point of how this is a complex system, I don't think that, you know, can be easily overlooked, given that if you were on Lake Champlain, Lake Ontario last year, you were probably feeling the effects as well. And a question for you, being in Mallett's Bay, and I don't know if you would have any insights on this, but, you know, we seem, knock on wood, to have been spared some of the challenges that places like St. Albans and other parts of the bay, the lake have seen regarding invasive species, blue-green algae, and those sort of things. And kind of in my estimation, is it the fact that we don't have the big tributaries flowing in like the Missisquoi and some of the other, you know, major river streams flowing into the bay, or is the bay just big enough to absorb, to kind of buffer us a little bit from some of the problems that some of the areas in the lake are seeing? Thanks for doing this. I'll let you go, and I'll look forward to hearing what you've got to say on that.
Thanks, John. And, Eric, before you answer that, I'll throw in one more thing. Could it also be that Mallett's Bay doesn't have any farms right there on the bay itself? So can you answer that combo question from John and me?
Sure. I think I can give it a shot.
Right.
So first on the John's first comment on the Great Lakes system, that is a good observation. They also were experiencing high lake levels throughout the Great Lakes, which do drain into the St. Lawrence River. An interesting piece of information, though, is Lake Champlain is actually high at a high enough elevation that the flooding from the Great Lakes really doesn't impact Lake Champlain itself. It certainly affects some of the communities in Quebec farther downstream in the Richelieu River. But there's enough of an elevation change that the Great Lakes floods don't really impact Lake Champlain to any real degree. Just because we are high enough up, that there would have to be a lot of water that was coming through to make it all the way up to Lake Champlain from the Great Lakes.
All right, and the point about Mallett's Bay being less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's a great observation. Mallett's Bay has not experienced as many cyanobacteria or blue-green algae blooms as other parts of the lake, like I think John mentioned St. Albans Bay. Mm-hmm. And that is primarily because Mallett's Bay is a deeper and cold water bay. It's what we lake scientists call an oligotrophic, meaning it's cold and clear and does not have a lot of nutrients in it. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the main reasons that Mallett's Bay has not really experienced cyanobacteria blooms to any degree. I'm actually having trouble remembering if we've ever documented a cyanobacteria bloom in Mallett's Bay.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but he's right in that it's not as prevalent, certainly not as prevalent as we see in other parts of the lake, and partly in that it helps that we don't have, or Mallett's Bay doesn't have as large a tributary system. It doesn't have the Lamoille River, which is, you know, a pretty, for Lake Champlain, a fairly large tributary network. In fact, larger than what St. Albans Bay has. There aren't any real major tributaries that deliver nutrients into St. Albans. There's a number of smaller systems, but that does get to your point, Rick, about agriculture. You know, the Lamoille River watershed has a number of, you know, its fair share of farms, but there aren't that many right along the shoreline of Mallett's Bay. There are a number of, you know, as you are probably aware, there's a number of homes or second homes or, right, or camps along Mallett's Bay, and they can certainly have an impact. And and, you know, on some of the local water quality right along the shore, but St. Albans Bay is shallow and warm versus the deeper water and colder water of Mallett's Bay.
And let's get Jim in from Williamstown. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for doing the show and bringing back some bad memories.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I worked for the city of Barrie for 42 years, and there was several floods. But that year, we got a lot of snow. It didn't warm up during the winter, and so it never melted off. We had, like, a lot of snow to melt everywhere. Mm. And we got hit harder in May than we did for Irene.
Right.
Because we did a lot of work after May, and we got away with Irene slick. But anyway, I had to go to work. I live in Williamstown. There was only one route for me to get to Barrie because everything was washed out. The roads were closed. Route 14 was closed. Mm. The road in Graniteville was closed. I had to go down the middle road. And so when I got to work, I didn't even get a chance to punch in. The guy was yelling to me that there was an ambulance with a kid and on a fibrillator stuck between the washout by the dugout restaurant and then a culvert plugged up right by the car dealer there at the Dudley's car dealer. Mm-hmm. And they were stuck in between, so I got up there with a bucket loader and I cleaned the mud off the road. I got through it, and the ambulance guy says to me, because we knew each other, he says, "What are we going to do?" I said, "I'm going to do the same thing I did. I'm going to put my bucket down, go through that mud, and you just stay right on my tail and come through." And when I got through the other side, the water was as high as my bucket loader. You know, mm-hmm. It was splashing that high. And when I got through, I pulled off to the right, and he took off. I never did hear about the kid after, but
wow. Well, Jim, thanks for that story. Thanks for that work. We've got just a few minutes left, and I just want to get Eric Howe back in here. Eric, I know that after the flooding event, you had a conference with all the kind of stakeholders in the Lake Champlain Basin Project. And in just a few minutes, can you tell us what were some of the key things that you decided needed to be done for future, you know, to lessen the impacts of future flooding?
Sure. That's correct. We did hold a conference and published a report, which is available on the Lake Champlain Basin Program's website. Mm-hmm. At a high level, several of the recommendations from that report looked at zoning, particularly for shoreline. At that point, anyway, lakeshore towns. Encouraging towns to take a hard look at how they allow development along the lakeshore, at what elevation, protection of our shorelines, particularly using natural approaches, trees and shrubs and natural plantings along the shore rather than hardscaping with concrete or rock seawalls. Mm-hmm. The trees kind of serve as a more of a sponge for not only for soaking up water, but more importantly, they absorb some of that wave energy, particularly at high lake levels, whereas the rock or hard seawalls just deflect that energy down the shore and cause a lot more erosion along the lakeshore. The International Joint Commission, which is a federal, binational federal agency between the U.S. and Canada, has been working on a study that should be wrapping up just about a year from now to look at some high-level mitigation or flood some high-level projects to address flooding in Lake Champlain down the road as well, and they'll be looking at ways to reduce the impacts of floods, both with using wetlands and other natural or green approaches, but also approaches downstream in the Richelieu River to reduce water levels in the Richelieu and in the lake itself. So that's a big study that's been going on for 5 or 6 years, $10 to $12 million, they'll be making some recommendations to the U.S. and Canadian governments about a year from now. And there will be a public comment period later this year. I think the study managers are waiting to find out or see what happens with the COVID situation before they schedule any public meetings. But there will be a public comment period later this year where they'll review some of the flood mitigation recommendations for the public to comment on.
Well, Eric, I really appreciate you being on. This is Eric Howe. He is the Lake Champlain Basin Program Director. And to learn more about the work of this organization, also to see the report that came out of that conference after the flooding of 2011, you can visit LCBP, as in Lake Champlain Basin Program, LCBP.org. Eric, thanks for that wade down memory lane this morning.
Very good, Rick. Thank you for the invitation to be on the show.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. If you're a restaurant owner or know someone who is, I want you to do two things. Pay attention for the next half hour and make sure you block out this Monday morning at 11. Now, that's all I've got. The rest is up to my next guest. Darcy Carter is the Small Business Administration's Vermont District Director, and she's going to tell us about the SBA's Restaurant Revitalization Fund. Darcy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Happy to be here.
Great. Now, restaurant owners, this is important stuff that could benefit you. So feel free to give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255 to ask Darcy about this grant program. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Darcy, what is the Restaurant Revitalization Fund?
Sure. So it's a brand new program that was passed under the American Rescue Plan under the new presidential administration. And it's a $28.6 billion pool of grant money that is going to be available to restaurants, food stands, bars, food trucks, caterers, coffee shops, ice cream shops, and a few of other like tasting rooms at breweries, brew pubs, wineries, distilleries that have, you know, retail space there. So it's kind of a wide group that's eligible. It's not a loan, which makes it even more attractive, of course. No one has to repay the money. But it's really trying to, you know, replace that pandemic-related loss of sales that all of the, you know, food and beverage industry has faced this last year. And it's going to start on Monday, actually at noon. People can register, though, on Friday starting at 9 a.m. to get an account. There's like an authentication kind of process that is kind of an industry standard now. And so we want people to get a head start on that on Friday if they can.
All right. I said 11 people should be ready, but that gives them an hour to sit there at their computer on Monday to be all ready when things get going at noon. What are the amounts of the grants that will be awarded, Darcy?
Sure. So it's up to $10 million or $5 million per location, and you can't have more than 20 locations. And SBN Congress worked a lot with the industry, and what was the norm for the restaurant industry is that often there's more than one location and there's multiple owners, different owners in every location, in addition to the very smallest of the small that might be a food cart or a food truck, something like that. So they want, so the minimum grant amount is $1 million, but the max is $10 million. And the way it's determined is they look at your 2019, basically it's called gross receipts, but your, you know, your gross sales, and you subtract your 2020 sales from that, and that's your pandemic loss. So that's a potential grant amount. And if you got a PPP loan, that is taken out of the potential grant amount because it would be considered a duplication of benefits. But if you got a state grant, that is not deducted.
So that pandemic loss, does it have to be a specific amount? I know, I think it was in the PPP, there was like, or maybe it was state programs here, there were certain amount of drop-off that you had to show, a certain percentage. Is that going to be required in this revitalization fund grant?
No, that's a great question. No, that's not required. You do have to have some reduction, though. Otherwise, there's no loss, so then you wouldn't be eligible.
Now, this
I mean, you can have less than the, you know, the 25%.
Okay, and this is the SBA that I'm speaking with, which is a federal program. You're the state director. Are the programs? Is this program being administered federally or through the state?
It's definitely federal. It's a national program, and so there's no like state of Vermont allocation. But the state works really closely with SBA through this whole last year in particular. So they take the federal programs into consideration when they develop alternative state grant programs, so that we're not like doing the same thing in the same space, so that the money, you know, from the different COVID recovery programs is you know, allocated as widely as possible. So people will be able to apply right on SBA's website, and they'll also be able to apply through what we call a point-of-sale vendor. I don't know if I can name them, but they're the ones, the payment systems that the restaurants use. You know how they flip the little thing around for you to do a tip or not?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of system. So those are partnering with SBA to make it easier so that the restaurant can go either through that system or they can get some information from their system, and that's going to expedite their grant application because it's a third-party verification. But if you don't use one of those systems, it's not a problem. You would just apply on our website. And I could give that out, or
sure, if that's, go right ahead.
Okay. So it's restaurants.sba.gov.
All right, restaurants.sba.gov
right.
Is the website. Excellent. Now, you said this is federal, and it's not, you know, decided by a state. So local places like Casey's Bagels and Citizen Cider are competing with restaurants and cideries from the rest of the country for these.
Yes. So that's why we want our Vermonters to be prepared. And the good news is the agency has put a lot of really good information on our website. It's basically telling you how to get an A on a test. Okay, so imagine the concern about, oh, I'm going to have to apply. What are they going to ask me? Well, we tell you everything they're going to ask you. It's right on our website, a sample application. And there's also webinars that are out that are going to be posted. There's one today at 1, and it walks you through the entire application, every single question. Once you get on the application, there's also, like, if you hover over a question, there's a little pop-up, kind of like when you do taxes with one of those programs, and it kind of tells you what we're looking for. So there's a lot of guidance. And also on our website, there's, you know, who's eligible, you know, how much can you get, how is the grant amount calculated. So there's no secrets. It's all out there. And it's also translated into 17 different languages.
Mm. That's great. Now, if I remember correctly, Darcy, one of the knocks against the PPP was that bigger chains were hoovering up large pots of cash. So what prevents that from happening this time around, from, you know, turning this into an exercise in futility for Michaels on the Hill or the Alchemist here in Vermont?
Right. I mean, we still have the challenge that the pool of money isn't large. You know, PPP just for this year was $284 billion, and this is $28.6. So that kind of puts it into comparison, right, that it's a smaller pool. But we think our Vermonters will be all right because we've been getting the word out. There's a ton of interest. The different restaurant associations have been way ahead of the curve, understanding us and sharing information with their folks. So basically, though, to give folks kind of the smallest of the small and different priority groups a head start, the first 21 days, the only loans that will be funded are those businesses that are 51% or more owned and controlled by women, veterans, or socially and economically disadvantaged, which is basically minority owned. So they're trying to give a head start to those groups, which have been the most impacted by this pandemic and didn't have the same additional resources, you know, to bring to bear to help get through the difficult time. In addition to that, I do want to say everyone can apply on that Monday, next Monday. Everybody should apply. Mm-hmm. It's just for the first 21 days, we will only be processing those where people have self-certified that they're woman-owned, veteran-owned, or socially and economically disadvantaged. The other thing is we have set-asides out of that $28.6 billion pool. $500 million is set aside for those businesses that make $50,000 or less in revenues in 2019. And then there's $5 billion for those that make up to $500,000 a year, and $4 billion for those that make between $500 and $1.5 million. So it's really trying to say out of that pool, we've reserved money for these businesses that the big guys with the 20 locations, you know, mm-hmm. in Texas or Florida can't get after that money. That's specially reserved.
All right, now you made me smile. I'm talking to Darcy Carter. First of all, I want to give that website again to make sure, and we'll give it at the end. I want to keep repeating this, to go to for information, to go to for the webinars, to get all the answers to the tests, questions, restaurants.sba.gov. Is that correct, Darcy?
That's right. And
right.
You can also do sba.gov/restaurants.
Okay. All right. I might be, you know, going over a few things, Darcy, in case anyone missed the first part of this conversation. First of all, let's talk about these awards, these monetary awards. They are grants not expected to be repaid.
Correct.
All right. And what information does someone need to have as they begin the application process on Monday?
Well, I think the best thing is if they can go, you know, to sba.gov/restaurants, it shows who's eligible. So there's two kind of groups. There's some that are presumed to have, you know, to be primarily serving food and beverages. And then there's secondary ones such as brew pubs, tasting rooms, bakeries, wineries, distilleries, inns, and things like that. who have some retail sales of food and beverage. And for those groups, they have to show that at least 33% of their gross receipts is the retail sale of food and beverage. So it's not a wholesale bakery program. It's a, you know, if inside your bakery you have a cafe and you're selling, you know, your beverages and food through there, you would be eligible as long as it's 33% or more of your total sales. So I just wanted to make that clarification.
All right. Now, Darcy, don't take this wrong, but government grant government grant programs aren't always the most intuitive things to navigate. When it's state-run, there's usually someone locally who a business can call upon to get help, and they get walked through the process. Will there be help of that nature available for this program?
Sure. So they can call us, 802-828-4422. Also can email me, Darcy, D-A-R-C-Y, Carter@sba.gov. And we also have a national customer service line that's available right now at SBA called, the number is 844-279-8898. I'll say that again, 844-279-8898. So that's a national customer service line that's already open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., Monday through Friday.
All
and
right.
That's where you can say, hey, I'm a new business. Am I eligible? And they will be able to say, yes, actually, this is a unique aspect of this grant program that people who have been planning to open their restaurant, spending money on the fit up and all those things, they are also eligible.
So wow.
You could be a not yet opened restaurant and still get a grant.
Oh, that's interesting. And I'll make sure that listeners that Darcy goes through those numbers, websites, email addresses one more time before the end. So if you missed them and you want to get a pen or jot them down, we'll do that. Let's go to the phone. And we've got Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I've got a question for Darcy.
Mm-hmm.
There is a new kitchen at the North Branch Nature Center. And they have many conferences. And I was wondering if there's any, if there are any funds for nonprofit organizations that provide food for conferences and the like.
And would these be internal conferences and meetings, Stephen? Or
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it'd be like evening programs or different conferences during the day, but they have a kitchen.
Okay.
And that's my question.
All right. Let's see what Darcy has to say about that. Darcy?
Sure. That's a great question. Unfortunately, in this program, nonprofits are not eligible. But that organization would be eligible for the Paycheck Protection Program. And of course, that is primarily for payroll for employees. But there is like 40% of the PPP loan can be used for eligible expenses, so it could cover some of the costs maybe for that part of the organization. The state also is planning to start another state economic recovery grant called the Bridge Program, and you might want to look at that and see if you would have any eligibility.
Great. Thanks for that answer, Darcy. Darcy, how can the money be used and by when someone receives a grant?
Sure. So it's really a wide use. So payroll, utilities, rent, maintenance expenses, supplies, you know, cleaning materials, personal protective equipment, food and beverage expenses, including like raw materials, inventory, insurance, marketing, license fees, legal, point of sale equipment. It can be used to pay your monthly bills, your credit card. You can pay off your credit card balance with it. You can pay your principal and interest payments that are business related. And also you can cover the cost of outdoor seating. It can't be used for any other kind of construction, though, which people ask a lot about. So I just want to get that out there.
And by when? I think there is a date that you have to use the funds by.
Yes, by March of 2023. So you do have a good amount of time. And SBA does look for you, you know, to spend it on those eligible expenses. And if you're going to take more than a year to do that, that's fine. But they will ask you to fill out like a template in that same portal that you applied. that just kind of report out on an annual basis how you've spent the money.
And you mentioned that the minimum grant is going to be $1 million. What happens if in that period?
$1,000.
Oh, $1,000. Okay, good.
Yeah. I thought
it was really high. Okay, great.
Yeah, we're all really right. generous at SBA.
Okay, good. And what does the business have to provide to show how and when they actually use the funds that they received from the grant?
Right. So when they apply, and I do want to mention that the application, the sample with all the questions is on the website, sba.gov/restaurant. So there's no surprises. All those questions are already out there, so you can be completely prepared. And so on the application, it will tell you what you need to upload, and that's what you kind of want to get ready this week, right? So mm-hmm. next Monday, you're all set. You got everything lined up. So it will be tax returns, business tax returns that show for 2019 and 2020 what your gross receipts are, because that's how we determine the grant amount. Now, if you weren't in business in 2019, that's not a problem. There's a calculation for kind of partial years and things like that. And also, if you're newer, it's based on expenses, eligible expenses that you've paid for, and that helps you determine the grant. So the calculation is right there on our website. It's really pretty, you know, basic. So let's say in 2019, your normal sales in a non-pandemic year are, you know, $250,000. And then in 2020, they were $150,000. So your pandemic loss, right, is $100,000. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's the potential grant amount. But if you got a PPP loan or two, those are taken out of that $100,000. Again, it's because it's considered, you know, a duplication of benefits. But if you got a state economic recovery grant, that's not taken out.
Do you have an idea how long a business will have to wait for an answer, especially those in that first priority group that you mentioned earlier?
Right. Their goal is 14 days. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that's how it works. It all kind of depends on if we need additional information. If there's something, you know, in the application that we're like, don't quite understand this, then we'll go and request some additional information. So then there's a little more reviewing that has to go on. There are several ways to apply that I mentioned before. So our website portal is restaurants.sba.gov. And that's where you're going to register on Friday, get your name in there, create an account, and that's where you're going to go Monday to apply. I'm losing my train of thought here.
That's all right. let's give a couple phone numbers if people need assistance on any of this, your local phone number, and I think there was a toll-free number as well.
Right. Yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right.
So our local number is 802-828-4422. And that's us right here in Montpelier. And we have a national customer service line just for this program, and it's 844-279-8898. Mm-hmm. You can also email me, Darcy, darcy.carter@sba.gov. And if I can't get right to you, I'll shoot it to one of our staff. We only have five people, so it's probably worthwhile to call the national customer service line if we can't get right back to you. But I would encourage people to go on the website where you can sign up for a webinar. There's one today, I think it's at 1 and also one at 2:30, where it walks you right through the whole application. If you can't make that, they are going to get posted to SBA's YouTube channel, and you'll be able to see it at that sba.gov/restaurants. Mm-hmm. The link will be there. And that's just really helpful. But if you can't do any of that, the application sample is on the website too. So just really encourage you to, you know, look that over, because it's going to tell you what you need to have ready to upload. And normally a PDF kind of file is better.
All right, Darcy, we're going to have to leave it right there.
Okay,
Darcy Carter is the SBA Vermont District Director. Darcy, thanks a lot for being on this morning.
Thank you so much, Rick.
All right. We're going to learn about the wild turkey honey season coming up next after the CBS News. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. If you've ever seen wild turkeys marching around a Vermont field, they kind of look like a group of short old men strutting along with their hands behind their backs. Well, as of this Saturday, they better look out because turkey season opens up. And I'm pretty sure hunting wild turkeys is a lot different than hunting moose or deer or bear, and thus different safety protocols. Here to explain that is Nathan LaFont. He is a hunting education training coordinator for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Nathan, thanks for being on this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And hunters, listeners, if you'd like to ask Nathan a question, if you want to share your turkey hunting exploits, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, I think it starts Saturday, turkey hunting season, and then how long will that last, Nathan?
Yeah, correct. It's every year it's going to be the month of May, so it's going to be May 1st to May 31st, wherever that falls on. So it doesn't always start on a Saturday. It just happens to be very convenient this year.
And is there another hunting season for wild turkeys during the year?
Yeah, there's a spring season and a fall season. When you buy your hunting license and your turkey tags, you'll get two tags for the spring season and one tag for the fall season. And that fall season is it varies depending what you're using, whether that be archery or shotgun. But generally, it's the month of October and a little bit into the beginning of November.
All right, and you need the hunting license with the turkey hunting tag to be able to go out and hunt the turkeys this during May.
That is correct. Yep. Right. To hunt anything for that matter.
All right. Now, I see them in the fields a lot. If I have a license, can I just shoot them when I see them out there in the field?
Well, not necessarily. There's obviously the hunting license and the tag, and you know, laws regarding whether it's shooting from the road or on specific properties or that kind of thing. So we always, we always urge people to get landowner permission and you know, secure ethical landowner relations prior to the hunt. And just from a turkey perspective, you'll have a hard time getting close to a turkey if you're not calling them to you. Versus if you're trying to get to them, which is actually one of the things we don't recommend for safety reasons.
Ah. So how do you hunt turkey? Do you have a stand like in deer season?
Not necessarily a tree stand. Some people do use a ground blind, which just to conceal themselves, conceal their movement a little bit more because turkeys do have very, very good eyesight. But generally, it's the mating season for the birds, so the best way to do it is to imitate a hen. To get a tom or a jake, the male birds with beards, to come towards your hen call, thinking that you're a hen calling them. You can also use hen decoys to make, give them a visual, to come to, and then as well as, that audio call that you're using, is gonna get to come to your position where you can get a good shot at them.
And you said they have great vision. That was actually one of my questions. So that's very interesting. But, yeah. I mean, will they, just because they see a human, is it the size of what we are that would make them skittish? Or, what would they be picking up visually that might scare them off?
The main thing is going to be movement. And that's movement at all, not necessarily human movement or the shape of a human. But specifically this time of year, with, like I said, either mating and then the hens later in the season would be on nest. So they're looking for predators. They're looking for any sign of danger. And again, that may be a coyote. That may be, just a house dog sneaking up on them playfully or anything like that. But certainly a human sitting in the bushes, in May is something that they should be aware of.
Yeah. They think back to last May. Oh, this isn't good. This is that month they come out that gang. All right. So how do I pick out, Nathan, a proper tree or rock to sit near?
Yeah. So, Turkey habitat is going to be, it's called edge habitat, so it's a field nearby, but with also a good block of forest, and they, you know, they'll use both areas, that forest and that field. So generally you're going to set up on the edge of the field. That does a few things. It's A, where the turkeys are, B, it gives you a really good viewpoint and vantage point, so you know, maybe they might come out on the other end of the field, but you're able to see them and you're able to start working them with your box call or your mouth call. And the other thing it does is it hides your silhouette up against the trees as well. As far as a specific tree, you're going to want to look for something specifically bigger than your shoulders, and that can be hard to find in Vermont a lot of times, but basically what that does is if there is another hunter that doesn't happen to know you're there and takes, you know, a shot that maybe they shouldn't have taken, then it would protect you from your backside a little bit, and maybe some of those BBs would go into the tree versus, you know, maybe striking you. Very rare occurrence, but it is just a little thing you can do to increase your safety just a little bit out there, as well as it's comfortable. It's just comfortable to have something to lean up against while you're sitting out there. A lot of times, turkey hunting, you're sitting on the ground to try to make yourself smaller and conceal yourself a little more. So it's kind of a win-win all around.
Gotcha. Now, you said I want to make a hen call calling Tom's and Jake. So which turkeys are legal during this season?
Yeah, so the law states that any bearded bird is a legal bird in the spring season. In the fall season, it's either sex. A bearded bird could be a Jake, which is an immature turkey or a younger turkey with anywhere from even a half an inch beard, which would be hard to see, to a couple of inches long. And then a Tom is a mature bird, which, you know, those beards can get 12 inches long, give or take. And that's, you know, it's a good sized bird. And the other one, which is more rare, is a bearded hen, which is also legal because the law is written that any bearded bird is legal. So a bearded hen, should you see one, would be legal.
All right. And is there a daily bag limit, a season bag limit, no limit? What's the limit on this?
Yeah, so it's just going to be the tags that you get. So not necessarily a bag limit, but you get those two tags in the spring and then the one tag in the fall. So so you could, you know, you could, if you were lucky enough, get both your spring birds in the same day or even the same shot.
Gotcha.
And then you'd be done for the rest of the spring season, and you could go out again starting in the fall season.
All right. Now, Nathan, don't laugh. I saw something that said, never stalk a gobbling turkey. And I know real hunters are about to laugh, but I thought all turkeys gobbled. So what does that mean, never stalk a gobbling turkey, and why?
Yeah. A lot of people do it, and it can be effective, but it's not recommended from a safety standpoint. And generally, it's just going to be the males, and specifically the toms that gobble. It's a power and a hierarchy thing in the flock. But if there isn't a tom, then the jakes are going to be more likely to gobble. But a hen can gobble, but it's very rare, and they don't really do it. But turkey hunting is one of, you know, you can't wear hunter orange because of their eyesight, and you just wouldn't have very good success wearing hunter orange. We recommend you wear it anytime, you know, coming in or out of your stand, or specifically if you shot a bird and you're carrying it out of the woods to wrap it in orange or put orange on yourself. But when you're sitting there, you can't wear orange. So that creates a bit of a safety hazard. Of course, we always recommend everybody out in the woods, specifically during a hunting season, wear orange, but it's just one of those things you can't do with turkeys. So if you add in movement, if you're trying to stalk a bird and moving around, maybe close to the ground, you know, about turkey size, you're increasing that risk of someone possibly mistaking you for a bird, which again is very rare. But anything you can do to make yourself a little safer out there is always a good thing. The other side of that is we also recommend to never use a gobble call. There are calls that imitate the gobblers, and what that does is, you know, they puff their chest up and who else is in my area, and they'll try to come over, and you could get a shot at them that way. But we don't recommend using the gobble calls because other hunters out there are listening for the gobble calls, and they might come stalk your gobble call thinking you're an actual turkey. So between not stalking birds and not using a gobble call, that whole safety issue could completely go out the window and just overall improve your improve your chances of having a safe hunt.
I'm not going to ask you to perform unless this is something you're really good at, but is the difference between a gobble call and a hen call quite noticeable?
Oh, yes. Yep. And I would, I'm not going to try to do a gobble call here,
darn it.
But I would definitely, if anybody's interested, I would definitely just go on YouTube and maybe search turkey sound. The hen, it's more, I don't know how this is going to come through on the phone here.
I'll give it a shot.
It's more of like a... So it's more of a that, and you do have either friction calls, box calls, or mouth calls that sound better than that. That was just my own making sounds without a call.
It sounded great. The audio quality is fantastic.
Good.
Yeah.
And then a gobble is going to be more of a thunderous. You know, you're going to feel almost like the bass in your car. You're going to feel it in your chest, and it's going to be very, very different and very noticeable.
Okay,
but
good.
For sure.
All right. Yep. One, more resonant, the other high-pitched.
Yes.
You mentioned Blaze Orange, not wearing that as you're hunting, but maybe once you have a turkey and then are walking out. But what are the right colors then to wear when you're turkey hunting?
So it's going to be some sort of camouflage, whatever your is in your area. They do make different patterns of camouflage for grasslands or for hardwood forest or softwood forest. And a lot of times you don't have to get too picky with that, but the closer you match your surroundings, the less they might be able to pick you out. And then other colors to specifically avoid are going to be red, white, blue, and black, and mainly just because those are the colors of a turkey, and specifically a male turkey's head, have those red, white, and blue colors. It's the same idea as, if you're going out in deer season, you probably want to avoid wearing something brown in color or white in color specifically for their, for their tail. Same reason. Just it's never a good idea to dress up the color of something that's in season.
Gotcha. All right, Nathan, is that a good gobble?
That's a good gobble. All it doesn't come through with the face as much as you'd feel in the woods, but
all right.
It gets me going. I'm excited now.
All right, excellent. All right. We're going to go to the phones and take a call from Stephen in Montpelier. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I have an observation and a question.
Sure.
Occasionally, turkeys will just come up to the house and wander around on our porch. And my dog, Riley, and I will sit here and watch them. And so I'm just wondering, are all turkeys the same? Because these turkeys seem to be occasionally, not always, but some turkeys just come and they seem to be so tame.
That's a great question, Stephen. Nathan, what have you observed of our wild turkeys? Do they have that kind of tame, docile kind of nature by generally?
Yeah, they're not ever really going to be out there looking for, they're not a predator. They're not a carnivore really of any sort. So they're always kind of in playing defense or in protective mode. And like a lot of animals, depending how, what the human density is, whether it be more urban or suburban or rural, they just might get habituated to having people around and maybe even trusting people a little bit specifically. If you're having cookouts in that backyard and they see you there, then over time they realize, okay, well, I'm not going to get hurt in that area. I haven't been hurt yet. And they might move in a little closer. The other thing, that could possibly be going on in some of those scenarios is they could be, coming in to scratch the bird feeders or anything that was dropped off from the bird feeders, which we want to try to avoid feeding, any big game or any wildlife, even incidentally if possible. But that could be, if there's any sort of food source or perceived food source there, then they might it might be willing to risk a little bit more danger to come into that source.
When I've seen them, they always seem to be moving in gangs or packs, of a number. Like I usually see about 10 of them together. Is that normal? Is that how they tend to move about?
Yeah, they're almost always it's going to be slightly different for certain times of year, but almost always going to be moving around in a flock together. And part of hunters can use that to their advantage a little bit as well, because they go up in the trees and roost up in the trees at night, and they fly down a little after daybreak. So if you're in early, before the sun comes up, you can start talking to them while they're still roosted. And then part of when that time of the day, they're trying to get their flock back together, because they all fly out of the tree kind of different directions and then use their calls and voices to gather back up as quickly as they can. So again, if you're doing one of the calls, they're going to say, okay, we need to go over here and flock back together, and they come to your position. But yes, they are going to be in flocks most of the time, and that's a protective measure as well, because if, say, a coyote did come after the flock, the coyote might get one, but it's not going to, the rest of them are going to be able to escape. Versus if they were all individuals, then multiple coyotes throughout the landscape would be able to get multiple of them. Mm-hmm. So it's an evolution, designed trait there to be flocked up.
Are they good at flying?
They don't want to if they can avoid it, but they are very good at flying. I was actually just driving down Interstate 89 the other day, and one flew kind of, up over the two lanes, across the two lanes. I was like, that was a turkey. So wow. They're quite large as well. So
yeah.
You want to fly it's a treat there. But they do fly up into the trees and fly out of the trees, every night. So it's something they can do, and they can do it also to escape danger if they feel it. But kind of a last resort thing. They'll run before flying if they can.
Can I use decoys when I'm hunting wild turkeys?
Yeah, absolutely. You can't use a live decoy of any sort, but many stores sell plastic and different materials of decoys, and generally you want to use, like I mentioned earlier, a hen decoy.
Oh, did we lose Nathan? You still there, Nathan? Oh, I think we might have lost him. Let's try to get Nathan back on and finish the conversation. I'm speaking with Nathan LaFont. You probably have to call him back, Danny. And he is from Vermont Fish and Wildlife, a hunting education training coordinator. And the wild turkey hunting season, the spring season, opens this Saturday. It goes from through the month of May. And we're learning all about wild turkeys and also about hunter safety involved with hunting wild turkeys during the month of May. And unfortunately, we lost Nathan. I think we're going to get him right back on. So if you do have a question for him, we're at 244-1777. Call us, not him. 877-291-8255. You back with us, Nathan?
I'm here. I don't know what happened.
All right. That's all right. Well, it's the wonders of modern technology. That'll happen a bit. So you said you can use decoys. Where would you place decoys?
In your line of sight, because that's probably where the bird is going to come to that you're trying to get a shot at. But also in an area that's kind of protected from you, and that's kind of a double negative there. But if there was going to be some sort of safety incident with another hunter, there's a chance that incident involves them shooting at your decoy, thinking it's a real bird. Therefore, you don't want to be lined up directly behind your decoy in that potential line of fire. So kind of off to the side, but also still in your line of vision. Whereas if someone was to shoot at it, they wouldn't strike you.
Gotcha.
Obviously, that's still a major issue. You should never take a shot unless you are absolutely sure of, it's safe, legal, and ethical. You're not going to hurt anybody. It's a legal animal, and you can get a quick, clean kill, and you don't want to have that animal suffer at all.
Right.
And if you're going by those three principles and those three questions you should ask yourself, then, none of these potential scenarios should even happen. But safety is in your own hands out there. So, and that's just in life in general. But, all these things are just going to increase your chances of having a good day.
You mentioned another hunter. What if I see another hunter? Is there a proper protocol?
There's no set protocol. You could either just flag them down in some way, make sure they know you're there, specifically if you're in the same field. Then there's a chance that if either one of you gets a shot, their pellets can cross and come across the field. And if they don't know you're there, then that can, be a little scary if they happen to shoot in your direction. Shotguns are used, or bow and arrow, but mostly shotguns in the spring season. and they don't travel very far. It's not like a rifle where they can travel, you know, miles and miles. They're going to lose their energy after, you know, 50 plus yards, 50 to 100 yards. They won't go much farther than that. But still, anybody shooting your direction with any sort of firearm is not a good thing. So just let them know you're there if possible. And that might even come down to, you know, hollering out and saying you're here. And of course, that might scare the turkeys off as well. But safety is the number one priority. And so the other thing is if you're on, you know, if you're at another way, another good thing about getting landowner permission is you could ask if anybody else has permission there or if there's other, any other hunters that are going to be there. So you can, you know, possibly anticipate that a little bit more.
Nathan, how will these turkeys compare in size and taste to the domesticated birds that we have at Thanksgiving?
Sure. The butterballs.
Yeah.
Yeah. They, right. The size is going to be just a little bit smaller. Your average turkey, and I'm just pulling this off the top of my head, your wild turkey is going to weigh between 12 to 22 pounds, 23 pounds maybe on the larger side. And again, that, you know, that's going to be the you know, the head, the feet, the feathers, the skin, and all that, and the innards all still in there is when that weight is taken. So. It's going to be cut down by quite a bit, but comparable, but just a little bit smaller. As far as taste, they're going to taste quite a bit different, and depending on your taste and depending your experiences, some people think it tastes much better, and some people think it tastes much worse than the Thanksgiving butterball turkeys. And I think a lot of it, too, is in how it's prepared, and, you know, it maybe just has to be prepared different from how you would do your normal store-bought turkey. And get creative with it. We've done, a couple field-to-fork events with turkey and different ways of using them in ways you might not have thought about. And just get creative with it.
Oh, that sounds
fantastic. If one way doesn't work out, try another.
I love it. Nathan LaFont is a hunting education training coordinator for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning, Nathan.
Yeah, anytime.
All right. We're going to break for CBS News and then return for a half hour of open phones. Listeners, it's up to you. You can call now, 244-1777-877-291-8255. I'll throw out some topics when we come back, but if you've got something on your mind, you can jump on the phones now. And don't forget, coming up at 11 on WDEV, it's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, let's open it up. We were talking hunting safety before the break. If you want to tell a hunting story that's suitable for the air or brag about a hunting exploit, now's the time to do that. 244-1777-877-291-8255. On Monday, Melissa Passanen told us about her new cookbook that's filled with classic Vermont dishes. I'd love to hear what your specialty is, even if it's switchel. You know, switchel, Danny? All right. We got Sox Mets tonight. What do you like about this season? Does it have legs or the arms? Pitching's actually been pretty good to make it to the playoffs this season. There's a lot of parity in the American League so far this season, in all of baseball, that is. So maybe our Sox are right there, but it looks like, you know, you get on a losing streak and you could be just underwater in a season like this. No one's taken me up yet on talking baseball, or Sox or Yankees or whatever. 244-1777-877-291-8255. You can talk Celtics, and if you do that, I'll have to bring Danny McGivergan on because he is an expert on C's basketball, follows him very closely. We can talk vaccine. I got dose on Monday afternoon, and I feel great. Got it in the dominant arm, as I think it was Nurse Cindy suggested. I drank lots of water. I took a couple of Tylenol, but really didn't need any more than that. Feel like someone punched me in the arm, yeah, but that's abating now too, but no problems. So a lot of people have been worried, and I guess some people have reacted, especially on that second dose, but I got through it with flying colors. I think I did. I mean, the last couple of days, maybe I've been screwing up more than usual, and you've noticed, but I think I got the proper amount of sleep. Let's see. We talked haiku on Friday, and if you got haiku, bring them on. We're always ready for a little bit of that. It's still poetry month, I think, through the month of April. All right. Our numbers are 244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. If you don't call, I do a half-hour monologue, and that's not good for anyone. You know, we have Anthony Lamb from the University of Vermont playing for the Houston Rockets, and it looks like he must have picked up some playing time a little bit and his shooting. He's up to 3.6 points a game, and he was around – I think two after the first maybe 10 games, he was having problems shooting. So it looks like all of a sudden Anthony has picked it up some. What do we see here? He had 31 minutes the other night against Denver and had 21 points. Are you kidding me? A career high. Yeah, so he had 8 the game before against Utah, which is a great team, in 5 minutes. And then he went a little bonkers there against Denver. 21 points for our Anthony Lamb from UVM. Well done, Anthony, in 31 minutes. So that can only mean good things for Lamb, and hopefully stays with the Rockets. Right now, not a bad team to be on because they're crap, and that'll get you some playing time. You know, it's not a bad thing. You get more minutes and maybe, yeah, really start to fit in the NBA, and it looks like from that last game against Denver, that really was a step forward for him. Okay, I want to throw out some numbers again in case you didn't get everything. When we were talking to Darcy Carter from the SBA, there is this grant program, Restaurant Revitalization Fund, and if you didn't hear, you know, this is $28 billion nationally that will be parsed out to restaurants, distilleries that have, you know, food operation, bars, et cetera, bakeries that have, you know, that sell their goods right there, not wholesale bakeries. And if you're interested and you could use a grant, there are several things you can do. First of all, go to sba.gov/restaurant. All right. sba.gov/restaurant. And you can also call if you have questions. 828-4422 is the local number for the SBA. The national number, 844-279-8898. And those numbers are if, you know, you're in the process and you could use some guidance. You can also email Darcy, D-A-R-C-Y, .Carter@sba.gov. And you can always call me if you need that information, if you're a restaurant looking to apply. That starts Monday at noon, but you can go online ahead of time to start the process. You can also, they have a webinar coming up this afternoon that you can, they'll pretty much tell you everything you're going to need to know. All right, let's go to Stephen in Montpelier. Stephen, good morning.
Sorry to bother you again.
Not a bother.
But I just have a story about Robin Roberts.
Oh, and, I love this.
Originally, I was helping start the Mountaineers.
Yeah.
With Eddie Walbridge and that crew.
Mm-hmm.
And Robin Roberts actually played for, I believe, the Montpelier team against
Barry.
It was
called the Twin City Trojans.
You're right. You have it right.
Yep.
And anyway, so when we started the Mountaineers, he came up and he threw out the opening pitch. And, you know, it was just wonderful to see him because he had been a pitcher for Philadelphia.
That's right.
And anyway, it was a lot of fun to see him and talk with him, and he would talk with the kids, and you know, it was just the good old days when the Mountaineers started.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to mention that.
That was 2003 when I first got here. They started within a few weeks of me showing up, and it was really exciting. It still is exciting to have this summer college team here. And I know Robin, you know, who played back in the day with the Twin City Trojans, and I guess they played in Montpelier, but Twin City representing Montpelier and Barry. And
right.
Yeah, and everyone, I guess, said he was just the most gracious person when he would come up for the events here.
Yeah, he was a wonderful person. I just enjoyed speaking with him so much, and I know all the other people involved here as well.
Yeah, so, well, I grew up outside of Philly, so I grew up a Phillies fan.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and now he would have played before I knew him, but being a Phillies fan, you know, we knew of Robin Roberts. He was a great pitcher in the major leagues. And so this connection to Vermont and the way he has accorded him, or he did accord himself when he would come up here, certainly made me very proud and happy to hear those stories. You never want to hear that, like, one of your heroes is a jerk, right, Stephen?
Right. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. He was so kind and gentle, and you know, he didn't put on airs or anything. He was just a good person.
Oh man, I love hearing those stories. Thanks so much for that, Stephen.
Okay.
All right. I'm trying to find some stuff on the Twin City Trojans. I'm not exactly sure if they were an affiliated minor league club. Someone might know that. I wasn't around. They were back in he played back in the 40s, 47, I think, is when Robert Roberts played here for the Twin City Trojans. And if you go to Montpelier and there at the Capitol Plaza, I think they still have a window display there that has one of like a uniform. It might be a replica, but it is of the Twin City Trojans. Looks like they played in what was called the Vermont Northern League, Collegiate League. No, maybe that's not it. Yeah, Collegiate League. Oh, so it was a Collegiate League back then from 1936 to 41 and then 46 to 50, one full season in 52. And so there were teams in Saranac Lake, Malone, New York, Lion Mountain, New York, Plattsburgh, in Burlington, and then in Tupper Lake. That was the first year that they had it. As a matter of fact, old Burlington Cardinals, people would remember them. Montpelier Senators, they were called for a while in the late 30s. And let's see what else we can find. We became the Twin City Trojans, in that 46 to 50 range. There was the Rutland Royals, the St. Albans Giants. Keene had the Keene Blue Jays, the Brattleboro Maples, I like that. The Bennington Generals, what a great nickname. We've got Bill joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi, Rick. How you doing?
I'm great. How about you?
Good, good. You were talking about Robin Roberts.
Yes.
I used to watch him go down to some of the games with my grandfather back in the late 40s, and he pitched for 2 years for Montpelier.
Yep.
And my understanding was that the reason he got here was he either was at Michigan or Michigan State, and the coach for the Twin City was Ray Fisher.
Oh.
And he was from the other school. So Robin was at Michigan State, Fisher was at Michigan. I might be have it mixed up.
Okay.
And so Fisher solicited him because he was, you know, he had pitched against his team back over there in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Roberts had that fantastic year.
Yeah.
That last year he was here. I'm not sure if it was 48 or 47, but I just found that very interesting. You're talking about the Twin City Trojans and what went on back in that time.
Did they play out, Bill, did they play out at Recreation Park there where the Mountaineers play? Yeah.
Recreation Field, yeah. That was pretty new at that time.
Oh, my.
And, it was really nice because they had the stands there and everything, you know, just like they have it now, except it was quite a while ago.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. Wow, what a memory. That had to be great. And you went on to become a Hall of Famer in the majors.
Sure did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had a chance to see him one time when he was coming up here along about, I guess you were talking about the early 2000s.
Right.
For the Mountaineers. He came up to plug the Mountaineers.
That's right.
And, yeah. So that was in the early 2000s, and they had a big dinner for him or something like that.
Did you get to tell him that you saw him pitch back in the day?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that is so great, Bill. What a great memory to have of baseball in your youth. And, I can still remember going down to Connie Mack Stadium in Philadelphia and seeing the Phillies play. And, you know, we would go down and the bullpen was right there. You could reach over and get the guys to sign your glove. And, you know, it would be some bum like Al Raffo, who nobody remembers, or a bullpen catcher like Vic Rosnowski. But they make an impact on you. You never forget them. Billy Champion, you know, for the rest of your life, right? Billy Wilson, all these Philly bums back in the day. And they just lock in. All right, here we go. Danny checked it out. Great basketball player as well at Michigan State, Robin Roberts.
Oh, okay, it's Michigan State. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, Fisher. Yeah.
Michigan.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. That sounds absolutely right. Wow. Oh, Bill, thanks for sharing that. That's so great. All right.
Okay,
you take care. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Greg.
All right. Okay. We're talking a little bit of everything. The phones are open, and we had a great baseball memory from Steven, and Bill added to it about Robin Roberts playing for the Twin City Trojans, which was a team that played here in Montpelier. Now, back in the 1920s, 1924, as a matter of fact, there was the Quebec, Ontario, Vermont League. It was a minor league, and there were two Vermont teams. I don't think they finished the season, but I'm always captivated by them, their nicknames. There were the Montpelier Goldfish. They finished 16-37. Looks like they didn't finish out the season. And the Rutland Sheiks, and they were at 34-20. Most of the other teams finished the season out with over 100 games. There were the Quebec Bulldogs, Montreal Royals, Outremont, which is in Montreal, Outremont Canadiens, and Ottawa Hull Senators. Wow. So really spread out, the six teams in that league. But yeah, Montpelier dropped out on July 15th. And then they changed the league name to the Quebec Ontario League. That's pretty interesting. All right. Now we're going to Elmore. We've got Don on the line. Hi, Don.
Hey, I have a question. What ever happened to the old Eastern Border League?
Ooh.
I understand it. We had a team in Morrisville back in the early 60s, and we had a fellow that was out of the Braves network, I believe, as a coach, Bert Adell or Aguirre, I can't remember his name. But it seems to me that a lot of the towns in northern Vermont were part of that at that time. And you talk about college kids playing on some of the teams. They had a team in Winooski at that time, which had somebody out of UVM as their pitcher. And I can remember we went down and played them and lost 31-1. But it was a fun thing. And that's what it was all about at that point. But I know we were a Red Sox farm team somehow.
And about what era did you say, Don?
1960, early 60s, 60 to 64 along there. I've got no idea whatever happened to that league, and I can't find anybody else that remembers either.
All right, I'm going to have to do some research. I didn't find anything off the bat, but we'll put that out there.
Before you go, though, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I left you a note with Tyler this morning on Thaddeus Stevens and the tapeworm. Double-check that with her.
The tapeworm?
Oh, yeah. He got himself involved with a railroad that he had the state subsidizing to go to an iron operation that he was trying to open up on Shacks Mountain, on the west side of Adams County in Pennsylvania, and he was known as a scallywag down that way.
Well, as a matter of fact, you are right. He did have, and I was surprised Bruce Levine didn't mention this. He said he was a lawyer, but he did have industry there. And as a matter of fact, what's interesting, Don, is that in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, there is the Thaddeus Stevens, like, school of – it's like College of Engineering. I think it's like a junior college, but it's of industrial arts type of thing. Yeah, and so he definitely did have his hand in that business. And unfortunately, in the book, at least what I read, and I finished most of it before the interview yesterday, that wasn't really the thrust, you know, he really didn't go in that direction. So he kind of stuck to his efforts to end slavery. But it would be interesting.
Well, that's obviously a good thing.
I understand that.
You know, that railroad was partially built. I could take you out there any time on the west side of Fairfield. And as I say, it cuts along and started up over Jack's Mountain. And they got the road bed built. It never had rail on it.
Oh my gosh.
Was the one that was promoting it, and as I say, got the state to fund a lot of it, and that's why they weren't happy with him. They felt it was a waste of taxpayers' money.
Wow.
There's good and bad in every person, especially when they're in politics.
Yeah, you know, power corrupts, they say, and so it can definitely happen. Tell me again where that was, where that rail line was going to be.
The road bed that's still there is on a road that goes up over Jack's Mountain from Fairfield.
Mm-hmm.
Jack's Mountain, and then there's a large, I guess it's a slate mine up there now where they bring out slate and granulate it for use on shingles, and it goes all out of there and covered hopper cars on the railroad.
All right. Boy, you're giving me a lot of homework there, Don, but I appreciate it. It's great to hear this kind of stuff, to learn new things about this state I love so much. Hey, thanks for calling,
Don. Yeah, but if you
thanks
can find out anything on the Eastern Border League, I'd love to hear it.
You know I'm going to be talking about it. All right. Take care, Don. Wow, what a great call. Some great calls again. What a great day. I love finishing off like that. And I guess that'll do it for the day. Danny, you can shut the phones down. I want to thank everyone for listening, everyone who called in. Got some good baseball talk and even a little more Thaddeus Stevens talk in there. Seems everybody winds up in politics. I shouldn't say that. I don't want to say that. That's painting with a rather broad brush. Anyway, that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. And our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I love hearing from you. Thank you for any suggestions on topics or guests. Keep them coming. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.